everyone, and welcome back once again to the TetraCast. This is RPG Site's weekly podcast where we get the site staff together to talk about our favorite genre of video games. My name is Brian. We've got the usual crew here today. Joining me, we've got Josh Torres.
Hi, hello.
Adam Vitale.
Hello.
James Galizio.
I survived.
And Chow Min Wu.
How's it going?
We are recording this episode on the first day of February. It is February 1st. As we were putting together this outline, we kind of realized that this really isn't a surprise if you've been following, but we've got like three or four different people working on three or four different things that we can't talk about quite yet. So this podcast is going to be like, well, we'll get some of the news, obviously, that was announced this week out of the way. We do have at least one pretty major release this week that we'll talk about. But a lot of us in the background are working on things that you will hear about in the upcoming weeks throughout most of February, basically. But we do have some interesting stories. We'll talk about exactly what James survived. Yeah, Adam?
Yeah, I think I can say that I am playing Kingdom Come Deliverance 2, and that releases next week. So we'll talk about that next week because the preview embargo is lifted. And I think you can say what you're playing, Brian, if you want. But we're all working.
I mean, it's one of those things where if you look at the release calendar and you look at
you
the
can
date,
guess.
You can pretty much guess. Yeah, we're all playing those things. And, obviously those things will come to fruition over the next few weeks. But to start out this week, of course, we had the new Phantom Brave game release. We don't quite have coverage on that directly quite yet. But another game that released at the very end of January is Citizen Sleeper 2. Now, this is a game I'll have to rely on Josh's expertise here, because the first game I remember him talking about, a year and a half, 2 years ago when it came out, and thinking like, oh, I should get around to that. That sounds pretty damn interesting. And then, life happened and that didn't happen. But we have Citizen Sleeper 2, Starward Vector released, and Josh was able to put some time into that. So we'll kind of put our focus there. We'll have James do a little bit of story time with his last week. And then we'll go over the bit of the news as we go into the second month of the year. But we'll hand it off over to Josh to talk about his time with Citizen Sleeper 2.
Yeah, before James talks about his journey to getting 5090, that's not released this week, I wanted to first talk about a very graphically demanding game that requires a 5090. I'm just kidding. You know, Citizen Sleeper. Yeah, Velatro. Solitaire. Space Cadet Pinball. the Citizen Sleeper games are very like minimalist, not graphically demanding games at all. You can play them very, any setup pretty much. The first Citizen Sleeper game came out in 2022, and that became, quickly became an indie darling. It was a game that's like, it was very inspired by tabletop RPGs. You had this whole system that, any action that you wanted to take in the game was dictated by dice rolls. So in the first game, you were like an amnesiac. I don't know how to put this, but you're this entity called a sleeper, and this takes place in the far future. Humanity has already colonized and settled in space. So you wake up in this space station, and sleepers are essentially like robots, have a human emotions or souls to them. There's a whole world building and lore, like the kind of the origins of sleepers and how they, settlers from Earth decided to kind of quote unquote extend their lifespan through infusing, I guess, their being into like a sleeper. And then that, obviously comes into question of like, okay, is a sleeper just an extension of like the person that they originated from, or can they become their own person born from that? A lot of questions about the identity of like born from what is a robot on the surface level, etc. So Citizen Sleeper kind of laid those foundations and was a really cool, interesting story that introduce you to the system of, hey, if you want to go work on like repairs that'll cost you one of your five dice rolls, and depending on what class you chose at the beginning of the game, you might have bonuses to your dice rolls and might increase your chances because if you because there's like positive outcomes, neutral outcomes, and negative outcomes, and systems tied to what results you got from that. And then that first Citizen Sleeper got like 3 free DLC updates that continued the story in the sense that like the main conflict is already done. So it introduced like a new story arc that played out within those 3 DLC updates. And it was a really, really cool, interesting game. Like a lot of the strength of Citizen Sleeper and also Citizen Sleeper 2 is the pros of it.
So I guess my initial question is, I know they've said otherwise, but like, or they've said this, but should I play the original Citizen Sleeper before 2?
If I were interested. You don't need to like to understand like this main story, but I would heavily recommend to play the base game and all those 3 story DLCs, not just because they're good, but because there are some characters from the first game and those free DLCs that do show up in the second game. Like, you don't need to know them, like, their past, their background, to, like, understand, like, where they are into, but it would be nice to, like, you know, see them again, see where their story arc has led them and how they are incorporated in the second
game. And the original game is not long, right? So this isn't a big hurdle.
Let me go check my playtime on the first one, because the second one took me about just a little under 12 hours to beat. And then the first one took a little under 10 hours to beat. That's with the DLC update. So these are not long games. They're very, like, relatively speaking to other RPGs. I know still 10 hours is like a big, big number for some people, and that's fine. Just in terms of RPGs. So that would, like, when I talk about, like, the pros of the game, I mean, like, pros as in P-R-O-S-E, as in, like, the way that it's written, the way that it's very much a narrative-driven game, the way that the developers have written the script and the way that present text to you are all, like, very beautifully and compellingly written to you. And to give, like, an example of how it's presented to you, it's very much, like, you know, an easy comparison is like Disco Elysium and how like the text presented to you like on, like almost on the right side, and you do have like those. You don't really have to like the voices in your head in the same way that Disco Elysium does, but there is a certain element of like monologuing to yourself that's narratively interweaving into the narrative. Like there'll be some like entity inside you in Citizen Sleeper 1, for example, that like is something being born internally in you, and you're not sure what that is, and you explore that sort of similar element is in two as well, where you do have like sort of like an inner voice, but it's not like a lot of like multiple inner voices like in Disco Elysium. That's so in Citizen Sleeper 2, don't worry, I won't spoil anything. But I guess the only thing I will say is the very, very beginning story setup, like when you hit start game, you know, it's kind of like, it kind of has a very action-packed start in the sense that, like, once you start the new game, you're already kind of being, you're about to be experimented on by who will end up being the main antagonist, Lane, and you're kind of being busted out by one of your partners out of that dangerous situation. And as a consequence of, like, you not fully being rebooted from it, you kind of have a similar situation where you're playing a new sleeper in Citizen Sleeper 2, so it's a new main character, but you are missing your memories from the get-go. But it doesn't really weigh you down in a sense that like you're not really too bothered about like, oh, I don't know who I am. It's like it's very much about like moving forward, trying to like, you know, make the best of what you got, pretty much. You don't really dwell about, like, hey, I'm missing a memory. It's like, okay, what do we do to move forward? How do we make the best out of, like, a bad situation? So, after there's, like, a whole prologue section that introduces you to the mechanics of the game, and then, like, the quote-unquote real game starts after you, like, you escape, like, the tutorial section, something happens, and you end up at, like, your first sort of, like, space station destination. I think it's called like the Far Spindle, I believe, and it's just like it's just a small space station. The big difference with Citizen Sleeper 2 compared to Citizen Sleeper 1, structure-wise, is in Citizen Sleeper 1, the entire game takes place on this space station called the Erlen's Eye in Citizen Sleeper 1. So you're confined to this space station, and you're exploring sectors, different sectors of the space station, to move the narrative forward and to do your side quests, and you're learning more about like different characters that you interact with on this space station, and like kind of what got them there, what were their lives before that, what are they, what are their aspirations, goals, what are the reasons of what they do. In Citizen Sleeper 1, so you have a very intimate understanding of like a one singular environment throughout the entire game. In Citizen Sleeper 2, it expands this horizontally, where unlike the first game, you actually have your own spaceship and you're traveling to different like destinations on like a belt. And so, for example, some of the destinations may be other space stations, but they aren't as big as like the one in Citizen Sleeper 1. It might be to like smaller settlements that that like are cave, like that are located in the cave of a moon, for example, like and then there might be other settlements that like, you know, they found, you know, they're getting by elsewhere. So instead of like being confined to one destination, the Citizen Sleeper 1, Citizen Sleeper 2 is really all about, you know, traveling in between like a handful of destinations, like under 10, but still quite a bit in terms of what you're doing in that game. And along the way in Citizen Sleeper 2, you're actually gathering party members and managing different resources, unlike Citizen Sleeper 1. So for example, since you have a spaceship now, you have to think about resources like fuel, for example, which is something that a new system in 2 that obviously wouldn't be in 1, because you wouldn't need fuel in 1 because you're not traveling anywhere. That starts to really open up what different systems are in Citizen Sleeper 2.
It almost sounds a little bit more RPG-ish in that way.
Yeah,
go ahead.
When you're choosing where to travel to, I'm just kind of like thinking about the scope of this. Like, are there just like 3 or 4 places, or 12 to 20 places, or
like it's like 8 to 9? So like you're like, there's like actually like a map, and you can like chart a course, and then you'll travel then there immediately once you expend the necessary fuel for it. And sometimes like for side, there'll be side quest areas for a map. So for example, like this Far Spindle space station, I can zoom out once, and if there are any like side quest destinations that I picked up like on a bounty board, I can travel there for some fuel, and then I'll get into this in a bit, I can travel there, and then after I've done with that side quest stuff, I can immediately travel back to the spindle, and then from the Far Spindle I can go to like a bigger overworld map or over space map. And you can go to farther destinations but you'll spend more fuel in the process because they're further out. And then like there'll be sometimes hazards in the way, like for example there'll be either like radiated fields or like debris obstacles that like at the beginning you can't pass. And then you eventually, when you progress the narrative, you'll gain upgrades that will allow you to get past some of these environmental hurdles along the way. It's not super crazy complex, but there's a certain degree of like progression that you need to achieve to start, you know, fully exploring where you want to go. Like for example, there'll be a place that's in the center of like 6 or 8 destinations, but you cannot pass or be in like the airspace, so to speak, of this destination. So you have to travel around it meticulously to get to those destinations. But then as the story progresses on, you'll go to that place and then free up that airspace, so you have more direct access in between those 6 using that center one as a proxy now that you can jump between. So like just different hurdles and obstacles will be in your way that like you'll clear up as you progress the story, if that makes sense. It's hard
It feels it feels kind of like, you know, lock and key sort of thing.
Yeah.
Where, you know, it kind of gives you a progression in terms of opening up the space as you unlock the abilities in order to traverse those hurdles that you've mentioned.
Yeah. So some of the, like I said, so that's kind of like two of the big new things is like this party members and this having your own spaceship. So a lot of the, I guess, differences that you'll feel in between the two games is that in Citizen Sleeper 2, there's like this new stress system. And this really ties into like kind of like the more quote unquote side quest part of the game, or like the quest portion of the game, where you'll gain, like, let's say you go to a bounty board a quest board, and say, hey, I need to investigate like this abandoned space station. There might be resources alongside it, but it's been abandoned for a long time, so you don't know what sort of if there's looters still around there, if there's like any automatons or machinery that are still active that like may view anyone as hostile if they're close to you. But that's just an example of like a very simple like quest type that you pick up, and then so you pick it up, you go to that destination at the expense of some fuel, and then before you go onto it, you actually have the option to pick up to two party members to travel with you on this quest, and the quest presentation is very much like kind of like an overview map, like any portion of the game where like you're picking nodes and then putting dice in slots to do basically get a pass, neutral, or fail on a certain action. So like a lot of like Citizen Sleeper 1 and 2 is interaction loops where, let's say, I want to repair this exposed panel. How do you want to repair it? Do you want to repair it more meticulously through the engineer trait, or do you want to use you want to brute force it, and you have the engage trait, like engineer and or endure, sorry, not engage, and like endure and engineer, for example, are sort of like polar opposites of traits, where like engineer is more careful and endure is more like brute forcing a solution towards it. And that's how your class types, when you begin the game, feed into that, where you're kind of committing to like a class archetype that is more specialized into doing different things depending on like their trait, what traits they specialize in. So for example, I chose engineer or machinist. And an engineer is a trait, sorry. A machinist is, they're good at their bonus trait at the beginning of the game that they already have like a plus one in, is engineer. So anytime I slot in a dice into like an engineer slot, let's say I put in a three into an engineer slot, because I have a plus one, it'll turn that into a four. So I have a bonus to it already. So the odds of me getting a positive outcome is obviously boosted right from the get-go because of that class selection. Obviously, when I'm choosing in between, like, do I want to slot this dice to the engineer or endure trait for that control panel? Obviously, I want to choose engineer because that works to my class's strength. It's inherent bonus from the get-go on that. But the introduction of party members also helps this out as well, in the sense that party members have their own traits that they can slot their dice in. So for example, let's say I have Junie. She's like sort of like a a hacker sort of archetype. She's also, so she might be also good at like engineer as well. So when exploring the space station for this quest, I might be like on a timer where it says like you only have like 3 cycles, so like 3 turns, so to speak. And let's say turns are dictated by like they're like round based, right? So I expend all my dice, I expend all my party members' dice, then I go back to my ship and call and choose end cycle. Let's say that's like 1 turn. And then the next quote unquote second turn, I use my dice, I use my party members' dice, I go back to the ship and end cycle, that's like the second turn. Let's say I have 3 turns to open this control panel, or else I have to abandon the quest, the mission, because I took too long. That you only have 5 dice to work with, but you can choose, but each of the party members that you bring along with you have 2 dice with them, so you have 9 dice to work with, but not all of them will always be, you know, you won't always like want to use all of them for the same thing, because let's say I have a party member, like let's say I have Bliss and Junie along with me. Junie, I can use her engineer dice or her dice to slide to the engineer for the control panel, and then she's helping out getting that open. But Bliss, let's say, has the they specialize in the Intuit trait. And the Intuit trait is not an option in this Endurant and Engineer control panel action. So I can still use Bliss's dice on those slots, but they get a penalty on their dice because they can only normally use them on Intuit slots. And if they use them on anything else, they'll get a penalty. So let's say I slot in a 6 dice that they rolled onto one of those slots, they'll get an immediate -2 penalty on that action if I choose to go along it, because they're performing an action that they're not specialized in, or they don't know, like, you know, it's not their expertise. So like what would normally be like 100% positive outcome is now like maybe a 25% chance to have a negative outcome because you decided to take those penalties along with that dice action.
Silly, dumb question that is all just about like mental fortitude, kind of.
Sure. Yeah.
So, Baldur's Gate 3.
Mm-hmm.
I am bad at rolling with the punches. If I got a bad dice roll, I restarted. Like, and I'm terrible at just letting things lie. Does Citizen Sleeper allow you to like re-roll, or is it kind of you get what you get?
You get what you get. There's like an immediate auto save. So like
part of me is like that sucks, but also I'm glad, because otherwise I would not be able to resist the temptation of cheesing it, so to speak.
Yeah, I get it. There are definitely mechanics to offset like bad rolls, and I was actually going to come to this.
Gotcha.
There's a new system called stress in Citizen Sleeper 2, and this is kind of a weird system, but I'll try to explain it to the best that I can. This stress meter are like little pips, up to like I think 10 pips, above your dice roll, and each pip of stress basically is a probability that when you start a new cycle or a new turn, when you get your new set of dice rolls, there is a chance, depending on your stress, if there's no stress, there's no risk of this happening, but if you at least have one pip of stress, there's a chance that each of your 5 dice rolls will lose health. There is health for your dice in this game, which is a very weird concept, but I'll try to explain it. So each of your 5 dice has 3 HP. And so each pip of stress that you have, and when you start a new cycle, a new turn, the higher that your stress is, the more likely that you lose health for your each of your five dice. And it's not, and it's probability too. So like one or two stress has the potential to lose like one HP from one to two of your dice. If you start getting to like six stress, it's very likely that like maybe two to three of your dice will lose one health, and so forth. And it's a very weird system to think about, like, oh, each of my dice has health. And when a dice depletes their health to zero, you can no longer roll dice, that dice slot is gone until you repair it. And you cannot repair when you're outside on a contract, on a quest, so you can only repair it when you're done with it. So if you're starting to like break dice and you're still not done with the quest, you're still early on, it's a bad situation, because like, oh, okay, my main character has like two broken dice, so it can only roll three times. And the playable, or the party members also have stress along, have their own stress meter too. So some of them have four stress nodes. So if they keep on failing actions, they might start accruing stress. And once their stress meter is maxed out, you can no longer use that character and their dice rolls for the remainder of that quest, for that contract. So it's definitely one of those situations where you're balancing dice probability with trait advantages and disadvantages, and then you're also balancing a timer alongside that, and you're also managing stress levels. And to offset like bad dice rolls, there's actually a new action in Citizen Sleeper 2 called push, and when you use this push action, you can actually willingly choose to put one stress on yourself to up the number of your lowest dice roll. So, for example, let's say I have I rolled like a 5, a 6, a 4, and a 5, and a 2. And I'm like, okay, I can work with all those dice, but this 2 seems very risky. I can bump this up to a 3 using a push action, but I'm also willingly like giving myself one stress to up the probability of that of my weakest lowest roll, and so forth. So it's a lot of managing interaction loops and risk mitigation alongside it on that end. It's like early on, it's a pretty stressful game, and you're thinking about like how many systems it's like it's asking you to do. And there was a funny story where I had to actually I screwed up my first playthrough of this game. I got like an hour and a half or so in the game, and I had to
you're talking about this, yeah, in chat.
Yeah, I had to redo and start a new game from this, because there's kind of like an easy way to kind of catch 22 yourself very early on before you unlock the system to repair your dice. So I did like the first sort of like quest bounty mission that you had, that was like introducing like the stress system and how your dice can break and all that stuff. And I'm like, okay, well, I might as well like engage with the system. And so like in that first like quest, like I like broke like two to three of my dice. I was like, it can't be that bad, right? And then like you can repair them. It says you can repair them. So I come back and I didn't know that like I didn't have that option to repair yet. So I'm like, so when I try to like go to like the next like story mission, I only have like three dice I can roll, and it's not like it's like a very shitty situation where like I have to like kind of already walk uphill this early on. And I'm like, and of course I don't know at that point in the game when I would be able to like repair my dice and what I need to spend to repair it. And so I was like, okay, I might as well just start a new game since I can get up to where I am really fast and like be more smart about like how I'm approaching these early game situations. So it was like that really weird catch-22 of like, I could keep on pushing myself forward with really bad probabilities with very limited dice that I have, or I just start over and just like be more mindful about like my probability chances and keeping the health, actually properly keeping the HP upkeep of my dice and keeping my stress bar as empty as possible until I actually have the option to repair this, repair them. And it's a tricky thing.
How
too.
Onerous is it to repair?
So it's kind of tricky because you unlock it fairly early on, after you've completed the prologue, and it you can only repair dice when they're fully broken. You cannot repair from like 2 HP or 1 HP. You can only repair them if they're fully broken. So like there'll be times when you're like going on a contract quest mission. And let's say like 3 of your dice might have like 1 health left. You don't have any stress, but like, if you do take on stress by like, let's say a failed negative outcome, like even having 1 pip of stress and having like 3 dice with 1 HP, like hitting that end cycle is kind of stressful in the sense that like, it's like, oh, one of my dice might just like break when I press this, when I go to the next cycle. And you just never know. And to repair them, you have to go to your ship when you're on your downtime outside of a quest, and you go to this workshop. And there's 2 different ways to repair them, and it coincides with another system called the glitch system. So, but you can kind of improvise repair them in the sense that like you can repair them with more easily gotten like component items. But you'll incur more glitch. A glitch is a meter that goes down each turn, but whenever you go to a new turn and you have some glitch in you, there's a chance that you might get glitch dice. And glitch dice are pretty tricky because they are fixed outcomes of 20% positive and 80% negative. So there's only a 20% good outcome and 80% negative outcome out of glitch dice. That's non-negotiable. pretty much. So the only way to get rid of like glitched of glitch dice whatsoever, the only way to kind of get all your normal dice back is to let time pass by. Essentially, going to like new turns, new cycles.
I thought you were gonna say break them, get their HP to 0.
No, you can still use them, but it's very unlikely that they'll have a. Yeah. Positive outcome. But I mean, I still use them for, you know, just for safer actions. But there's another repair method where you can use more rare component items that you don't come by these very often early on. So if you're breaking dice early on, like getting like good repairs on them with minimal glitch accruement, is, you know, it's kind of tricky because you don't have a lot of these rare component items early on. So you can repair them using this more refined method and you get like maybe one pip of glitch. So like you can get rid of that glitch fairly quickly, unlike the other method, and so forth. And this starts to affect how character progression is in this game, because each of your objectives are called drives, and this was also in the first game and how they did this, where every time you finish a drive, you'll gain 1 or 2 upgrade points, depending if they're like a minor drive or a major drive. So minor drives are like more smaller scope scale objectives, might be like side quests, and you'll get like one upgrade point because those are, you've completed minor drives. Major drives are like big story beat progressions, or big story like, or big character arc quests that are completed, and these give you 2 upgrade points. But you need 4 upgrade points to upgrade one of your traits, and there's a new part of like your character upgrades where that interacts with the stress system, where like you can pick between like. Stuff like, if you get a positive outcome, you'll reduce 1 stress. Or you can choose that, or you can choose to +1 on that ability to add a point to your lowest dice. So you can choose between stuff like choose two upgrade points to either reduce one stress off of a positive outcome, so that's like a passive benefit to you, or you can choose that, or you can choose the ability to like say plus two to your lowest dice roll when you use the push system. So you have to choose between those. Or you can, or instead of choosing two upgrade points to for that selection, you can go to the other side of the character tree, and that is directly enhancing your traits. So you can choose to instead save your upgrade points till you have four, and then you can start to upgrade like your trait bonuses. For example, I already had a plus one to my engineer trait as a machinist. I decided to spend my first four upgrade points to further that trait bonus. So whenever I choose a slot and a dice to the engineer trait, I get a plus two bonus instead of a plus one. So that's very, very handy. So like even the worst dice rolls, like ones, are now upgraded to threes when I slot them into engineer trait slots. You can also do this for other traits as well, granted that like you're saving up your upgrade points and investing in that tree a lot. So let's say I started the game and I had no bonus to let's say Intuit. I had no bonus to that. I can choose I can choose to slot in my upgrade points and get bonuses to my Intuit get bonuses to Intuit slots instead. So it's kind of like, there's kind of like one of the weird issues that I have this game, where I think that half of the tree where you're upgrading trait slots is way more beneficial and has more value than ever interacting with the other side of the tree where you pick a selection between the two, because having bonuses to your traits that you can interact with is like way more beneficial and way more impactful in like any given situation versus like managing stress and the push systems, because they're more situational and conditional, while the trait bonuses part of that skill tree is more universal, always going to be useful for you. Like, so like even as a machinist, I spent my upgrade points fully getting my full two bonuses on engineer. Then I did it for like Intuit and like another trait. And then after that, I started working on engage. And then the only thing that you're blocked off of, and is this is true of each of the classes, there is one trait in each of the classes that will never be able to get bonuses. You'll always get a negative bonus out of. So for machinists, it's engage, where I will never get bonuses to engage. There's no way to do it. It's that whole trait is blocked off from machinist. So, but it doesn't matter, because like if I have bonuses to the other ones, that means that I don't have to worry about like slotting in or doing any activity that does engage, when there's usually another option or selection that I can do alternatively than the engage option. You know, so like, so let's say that there's a thing that I have to do, and it requires like Intuit. There's one for Intuit or one for engage. It's like, okay, well, I have bonuses to my Intuit. I don't have to worry about engage at all. So, you know, it's a non choice. It's like I never have to think about that.
It is kind of nice to actually like penalize isn't the right word, but have to make the specialization stick. Rather than, well, there's an easy way to undo this, you know, this trade-off that you've selected by selecting, you know, the engineer line rather than another line.
Yeah.
And in some ways it makes it inconvenient, because it's like, well, I will never have that option, but also like, well, then I never have to factor that in. It's just a non-choice. Yeah. I think in general, having not played Citizen Sleeper 1 or 2, I do like that they don't. It's good to be inconvenienced a little bit. I've said that mm-hmm. before, and I'll say it again in that way.
Mm-hmm. There's also I don't remember this first Citizen Sleeper have one had this, but throughout like some of like the story beats and selections and like the actual, you know, narrative reading part of it, there is some choose your own adventure selections in there where like do you choose to like, there'll be options where like, do you want to like use your Intuit trait to do this, and then they'll give you like percentage selections whether like how likely is it to you'll get a pass fail off of it. I don't know if the first one had that, but in this one you definitely have like your own CYOA sort of like mini selections to that have their own consequences depending on whether you pass fail them. There are definitely like times throughout the narrative that where it can that it can like shift the narrative severely. So for example, like there is, I won't say which party member what happens, but there is definitely one of those there were like one or two of those CYOA selections that I failed. So a certain party member, something happened to them and I couldn't reverse that whatsoever. Oh, okay, well, I mean, it wasn't a big deal, but like that sucks because I kind of like their trait selection. So, you know, something happens to that party member, and I could no longer select them after that. Then there are also a very few times where there are party member selections. I remember there was like one party member selection where like I finished their kind of recruitment quest, and then it gave me the option of like, do you want to recruit this party, this person, or this person? You couldn't recruit them both. You had to choose one or the other in that part. And also when you choose which party members get to go alongside you, they actually like have unique pieces of dialogue that they chime in to like the stories of that section. So there's, I wonder how many permutations there are per character, because like once you got like a whole like say like 5 to 6 characters alongside like your crew, and you have like free selection to choose who you want to go with. Like, I wonder how many branching parts of like unique dialogue and interactions are in general, because there are definitely like some quests where these characters actually interact with one another, depending on who you decide to go with. It's like, oh, like I actually had like complete control over like who I wanted to go with me, and they actually are like saying different things, and in some cases are actually interacting with one another due to like the context of this quest and so forth. So there is some sort of, there is value in like just bringing along like characters that you think are, that you like and or are relevant to like the current quest, because they might just have like different unique bits of dialogue.
You know what that reminds me of, and maybe Adam might be thinking of the same thing, Greedfall 1 actually did a really good job at that, in terms of actually having your followers like comment, and not just like, here's where follower A says their line and here's where follower B says their line. They like actually talk to each other, and like depending on who they are, it impacts the quest differently. So very RPG-ish in that sense. Another game that I was playing recently between assignments, Not as great of an example, but Starfield, despite all of its flaws, does a decent job with having your follower chime in on the quest at hand. But they have an easier job because you really can only have one at a time. So it's just like, that's very much, here's where the follower says their one line on the quest, and it doesn't interface with anything else really. So not still good for flavor, but not as good of an example. So very cool to see Citizen Sleeper 2 do that to the extent with multiple, you know, party members interacting in different ways depending on who you've got with you and what your current objective is.
Yeah. I think the tone of the game is like very similar to the first game, but it's very recontextualized because of the way that like there's a more like horizontal, bigger scope on it, where in the first Citizen Sleeper game, it was very intimate with that environment of like that singular space station. So you get, they explored a lot of themes of like how these characters ended up at this place and what circumstances led them to there, and like what in relationship they have to like a singular environment, like, you know, like how do they get by on this singular space station where the conditions aren't so great, but they have enough to get by. So, you know, the both of these games are very, very pointed criticisms towards like how, you know, the consequences of capitalism and how it affects people in different ways, and so forth. And Citizen Sleeper 2 has an interesting angle shift where it's no longer a singular place, but like where people have decided to settle across this belt of different destinations. So like there is some sort of I guess control over where they decided to end up in. So now you get to get to see a different angle of like why they decided to settle at where they are they're at. They didn't choose to like drift onto like this singular space station until like Citizen Sleeper 1. Like a good chunk of them are like, I want to be here because I want to be here. And like you get to see another angle of like, hey, there's a little bit more optimism when people are like have more control, have more agency of like where they decided to drift up. So there's like it's a really really interesting like angle where they're coming from, and how your own character like you know interacts with them, and how their relationships with you know different people of different walks of life evolves over time. But obviously I'm gonna skip around a lot of the Aaron narrative elements as people play the game on their own. I definitely don't want to give anything away on this. And I think it's a lovely game, both of these games, to just kind of just play and kind of chill with. I think the second game is a little bit more relaxed than the first game, in the sense that like in the first game there was always this foreboding sense of like looking over your shoulder, because they're like, since you're all confined to like one space on the space station, like even like the people that are hunting you, or the things that are like hunting you, or like are threats, they feel more immediate because their proximity is all on the space station. While in Citizen Sleeper 2, you have a little bit more mental breathing room to kind of evade those threats, because you have there's a sense of more space in between you and them. So there's less looking like looking over your shoulder and feeling like you're always being stalked, and also has like you know a stronger sense of community with others, because you're constructing you know your own party members and seeing like just meeting different like you know people in it and seeing you know what they're going through. There's a little bit more sense of like, hey, a little bit more sense of belonging, I guess, is what I'm trying to. Going here
is there with, do you think there's anything lost with that shift?
I don't, I mean, or is it just different, not necessarily better or worse. I think it's different, not that exactly different, not to say better or worse. If people wanted that, like you know, like standing on your toes, more standing on your toes type of feeling of like, oh man, I really had to tiptoe like around different things, I think the second one has less of that feeling than the first. It still has that in some cases, but in the first game, it's definitely, you definitely get more of that because you feel more alone and isolated in there. While in the second game, you're able to like kind of gather a group of people who you want to place your trust in, and in return, they place their trust in you to kind of fulfill their goals. You know, get a better sense of like you know, a family almost. So yeah, it's both of these games, strong recommendations. I won't say like they're the most challenging games, but it's fine. Like they're only really challenging like in the like the early, maybe early to mid game, because there's definitely systems in both of them where you can kind of really dominate the system once you understand certain interaction loops and how you kind of exchange like your resources with the system, where like you feed in item A and get back item B, and item B you can go to another place and get item C, and then item C is super valuable here, and you get more of item A, and then you know you can kind of do like interaction loops of like different sectors in both of these games, different areas like reward you for exchanging certain items or resources with them, and you get a big return. And then since you get so much of that resource, you're able to feed into another thing to get more of a reward on another thing, and then you kind of gets into like a cycle where you can kind of really stock up on your resources in a very short amount of time once you understand like where to slot in things. But like it's okay, you know, it's like it's not, you're really here more for the story, the characters, kind of the vibe of, you know, how people get by on really desperate circumstances, and in some cases, like the aftermath of that, of like, okay, the bulk of their struggle is behind them. How are they starting from nearly zero? How do they rebuild, you know, from catastrophe? And it's very insightful. It's not like trying to like beat you over the head with a lesson. It's more just like it's a nice piece of storytelling, you know. It's getting you to consider, like, you know, what the human spirit is capable of and what we're able to endure in trying times.
Maybe a little silly question, but does this game have controller support?
Yes, I played the whole thing on controllers, both of them. Yeah.
Mainly because it seems like I'm basically walking away with this with the same impression I had with Citizen Sleeper, that it just sounds really intriguing and also not a huge, like, opportunity cost to like try it. It's not like, yeah, this is a game that gets good 30 hours in. But like, yeah, perfect Steam Deck game is like,
oh, yeah, absolutely.
Next time I'm in that space, maybe that'll be a good time to just get those both loaded up and ready to go.
Yeah, for sure. You know, it's good. Like, when there's downtime in between assignments, you know, I just want to have a good time. That definitely strong recommendations. You know, it's easy. It's easy to get absorbed in them and just pour in hours into them, and then by the time it's easy to like play these games, then like 2 to 3 days later, it's like, I'm done. Whoa. Because you just got so absorbed in them. It's good.
I definitely need to get around to playing these. I hear nothing but good things about the first one and whatnot, so.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Josh, for carrying the mantle and talking about Citizen Sleeper, both 1 and 2. And I think that kind of covered us for games specifically for this week. Obviously, a lot more to come in the upcoming weeks. So we'll take the rest of this time that we normally earmark for game discussion to hand the microphone over to James and his week of surviving.
Yes.
I don't know how else to describe this. Obviously, the release of the new NVIDIA cards and scarcity, all, you know, the getting those things, you know, on the market and all those things. Go ahead.
So, if you're at all into PC tech, then you're already aware that the new NVIDIA GPUs just launched this week, but they are very much a paper launch. If you're not familiar with the term, paper launch basically means that there's almost no stock available at launch. It's only really available on paper. It's like, it's available on this date officially, but the stock isn't really there. And that's definitely been the case with the 5090. The 5080's been easy enough to get, so I don't think people are struggling too badly to get that, but 5080 is only like 10% better than the 4080. You can overclock it a bit to get it close to a 4090, but has less VRAM and whatnot. But the 5090, there, so across every micro center in the US, there was only 233 5090s available.
The crazy, crazy number.
Did you actually get one?
Yes, because the one and only Micro Center that had anywhere near acceptable stock was the Tustin Micro Center in California, because it's right like next to LA, Orange County. It's basically servicing the entire SoCal area.
Yeah, it's a lovely micro center. I loved going there when I was about, still living down there. It's awesome.
Yeah, so I got there on Tuesday. I just waited until the launch at 6 a.m. on Thursday.
Holy shit. So were you just there alone, or did you have anyone else with you?
There were other people in line, that's for sure.
But you didn't have like a party with you?
No.
Okay.
Were they camping, like with the camp gear and
yes,
the campfire set?
Yes. That's exactly what happened. And you could, and
you
could,
gear?
Yeah, I had a sleeping bag. I had a camping chair and whatnot. I was wearing layers, so it doesn't get that cold at night there, but I think like it got to like 43 degrees. So it was not great, but Tustin Micro Center got 67 5090s. I was 61 in line.
So 67 out of 233 nationally.
Yes. And to make matters worse, it was going to be less because Micro Center had originally intended for the Santa Clara, the Bay Area location, to be open by now. So I was actually talking with some of the Microcenter corporate types before they announced the allotment. I noticed there was a bunch of people there that were Microcenter corporate that aren't usually at that location. And the manager of the Tustin location, like before they announced stock, was being very coy. Well, not even coy. He was very much suggesting that if there was any one spot to camp out for a chance to get a 5090, it was that one location. And because he knew, of course he knew. So, yeah, like,
how long does the line get?
Over 300 people.
I'm trying to think, like, what was it, like, around the block?
It was around the block. It basically, yeah. it started from the front of the store, snaked out the side of the parking lot onto the sidewalk, mm-hmm. to the light at the corner, and then down the corner, all the way past that one Starbucks that was across the street.
Oh,
and
fuck,
almost,
okay. Yeah.
And then almost wrapped around all the way back to the to the other, like, entrance to the parking lot. It was,
and that's a big Microcenter too. It's like the just the physical space of it is. It's
yeah,
quite
it's, but yeah, it was definitely an experience. Because let me tell you this, I guess it's not really a surprise that I'll just say it. Like probably like half the 5090s that were sold there were sold to scalpers. It just,
oh yeah,
it. Like, and there was a bunch of people I was next to that were very obviously scalpers. There was a weird dynamic, though, where there was, like, the first person in line, the whole reason he lined up, and I don't know if he was a scalper or if he was just going for a card himself, but the reason that he lined up is that J2Sense, like, misunderstood that the line for 9800X3D restocks was the line for the 5090 launch. So he said something offhand in the video, and that person thought, oh, shit, there's people lined up. I need to get there. And then just never left. And that was on Saturday night. Last Saturday.
I couldn't be me. That's yeah. Right. That's kind of my standing on all this.
But anyways.
Was there any, like, okay, so we know that there's 233 5090s from Microcenters. Did anyone else, like, get a sense of, like, what were the other, what other outlet stocks were, like, how much Best Buy got or anything like that? Were there any rough
estimates? We don't know about Best Buy. I would assume that it was similar to Microcenter. Mm-hmm. But we do know some stock from, like, stores outside of the U.S. I know that, like, some major U.K. stores only got, like, 6 5090s.
Oh, geez, okay.
So it was not a lot. But the thing I was going to say is that, so the person at the front of the line, it was his first time doing a GPU launch, and he was like 19 or something. He was young.
Oh my gosh.
But the thing is that he was also like keeping track of people as they came in to kind of make sure there was a list so people wouldn't hop in line. And really greatly appreciate that. The people that were directly behind him. So you know how I said that there was a weird dynamic with people actually trying to get cards to game and some of the scalpers. If there's one thing that you might be familiar with, if you're into the PC hardware stuff, such as the like the 4090 and now the 5090, there's a massive like gray market to try and ship that stuff overseas to China.
What?
There's a massive, because 4090s and 5090s, you're legally, you can't ship them to China because of the AI performance.
Right.
But that doesn't stop people from doing it. Like, there's been, like, an epidemic recently of people reselling 4090s on, like, eBay or OfferUp for low prices, then get them and they don't work, and then you basically take off the heat shroud, and someone had basically desoldered the core chip and the memory modules so they could send those separately to China, because if it's not, like, fully connected, that doesn't get hit because they have to reassemble it there.
So, okay, so I'm trying to get a better sense. So, like, so you can buy one of these cards, and then if you take out, like, excuse my language, I have no idea what the terminology is, but, like, the AI chip portion of it, and they're still, they're still functional as graphics cards without
them. No. You desolder the entire GPU die and the memory chips, and then ship that along with the PCB separately, or you just ship the memory modules and the GPU die, and then back in China, they'll solder it back together.
Oh, okay, so you disassemble it and then you ship them piece by piece for them to reassemble it over there.
Because, yeah,
yeah, because I guess with the fully assembled part, customs will probably take it. Or
something. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's because it's technically illegal for them to get that whole
thing. But anyways,
together. So, okay.
Anyways, the point I was trying to make is that there was like two different types of scalpers in that line, and like the number two person in line was trying to pull some shady shit. Where they had like a big tent and they were rotating people out. There was only ever two people at the tent at a given time, but they were trying to say, oh, all six of us were here. So the other scalpers, the ones that weren't very clearly trying to send this shit overseas, like there was an uneasy alliance between them and the people actually trying to get the card, because it's like those people were like lawful evil. They were playing by the book. They weren't cutting in line. Like, some of them would sell their spot in line, or they were paying other people to wait with them, and they were there the whole time, and that's whatever. As long as you're in line the whole time, it's, like, fine. But the people trying to play game the system, there was some tension there. Like, understandably so.
Did number two ever get kicked out, or there's still...
So basically, at the end of the day, Micro Center said, hey, you only ever had two people in that line at once. We have multiple people confirming this. We took pictures of the first 30 people in line near the start. So you guys are only going to get two cards, because that's fine. Like, rotating people out, but having like at least two people there, I think having two cards for them is fine. You're still scalpers. You're still pieces of shit, but...
It's the most "quote unquote" fair way to handle it.
Yeah.
Okay.
But,
all right.
Was beyond that. It was interesting. Like, one of the scalpers, like, I actually fucking recognized him from the RDNA 3 launch in 2022, and he recognized me, which was like,
that's funny. Weird. But, that's awkward.
Mm-hmm. But it was interesting because that dude brought like a grill. He had he was grilling like skirt steaks one day and then like actual steaks the other.
Let's
brought
fucking go.
Like, people were like once the actual stock numbers were announced and everyone knew they were getting their card, it was a chill time from like 6 p.m. Wednesday night to basically the last 12 hours until everyone got their card, because it's like, okay. We've set the ground rules. People know that people cutting in line is not going to be accepted. And like, if anything, the tension early meant that you didn't have to worry at the very end, because it's like people knew that everyone was keeping an eye out. And if you tried any funny business, it was not going to end well for you.
Yeah.
And I say that, and it sounds like me, I'm trying to be a hard ass, but there were some people there that I would not mess with.
Oh yeah, these are definitely like you kind of form like a fellowship almost in those lines if you're there long enough and everyone knows each other. It's like, okay, we're once you get that confirmed group of who are getting the cards, you kind of establish that like almost blood bond with them. Like, I will stick up for you. As long as, like, you know, we're all good and no one tries any funny shit, we'll back you up. You know,
and that's exactly what happened. So, gotta imagine that they had less than 1,000 of these GPUs worldwide for launch, and I managed to get one. It's for the record, I was not going to upgrade if it wasn't for the fact that I sold my 4090 for what I paid for it. So, this upgrade was not that bad, especially since I also had like Micro Center gift cards. I think out of pocket I only paid like $300.
Okay. And it's like, yeah.
And it's like the 5090 is only like 30% faster, sometimes 35 depending on the game, but it's like, I mean, sure. This is my hobby. I love PC hardware, and it's like, as sketchy as it was in the moment, it's definitely one of those things I'm going to look back on and be like, yeah, I was there day one for the 5090 paper launch, got my card, and it's like there was some wild shit that happened in that line. Like when somebody tried to skip to like spot number 30 and then two people jumped, like him and when the person calling him out basically jumped out of the line, were starting to tear their fucking shirts off.
Holy
before
shit.
People calmed them down. It was, ooh, buddy, that. Yeah.
I'm glad you survived. I'm glad you're alive.
So before we ask about like, okay, well, how is the actual 5090 now that it's in your computer? I was following a little bit of your thread on the stories there on Blue Sky, and like there was a moment where like people realized like, oh, they're only getting Zotac branded cards and not MSI, and I forgot the other
Asus brand. Yeah,
Asus, and like, and for people who like follow graphics cards or like at least kind of get a basic sense about them, like, you know, Zotac isn't as prestige as like MSI or Asus, I guess, in this space. I don't know if that's changed over the years, but in general, whenever I was in the market for graphics cards, I was always told, you know, avoid Zotac if you can and go for MSI or Asus.
Yeah, that's the thing is that, you know, that I've mostly been an AMD GPU owner for most of my life. Like, I had like a HD 7850 and R9290 Vega 56, and then I had like a 6900 XT for a while there. So some of those NVIDIA only brands like PNY and Zotac, I didn't really have much experience with. My 4090 was a PNY, and I never had any issues with it.
Okay,
and from what I can tell, like, Zotac has gotten a lot better. And okay, first impressions with this card is actually pretty good, because I did get the Zotac RTX 5090 Gaming Solid. It feels well built. it feels well built.
So you see all, like, you see all the terms that they put on me. It's like Astral and Strix and whatever. Gigabyte usually got the good ratings, but then they just decided to stop one day. They just like, we're no longer making them. Like, oh, okay.
No, Gigabyte makes them.
Oh, they do? Maybe I'm thinking of someone else. I remember there was someone else that was just like, we're out. Peace.
Yeah,
I'll look up who
it was. EVGA. EVGA.
Oh, that's what it was. Yeah,
oh,
that was
yeah, EVGA. Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, but I'll say this about the new Zotac GPU. It feels solidly built, funnily enough. But the performance is good. Temps are good. The noise is good.
Did it come with a kickstand or whatever? A little thing that holds it up?
Yes, it did, actually. And that's one of the things I wanted to mention, is that it had a much better built support bracket than what Asus and MSI are giving you, which is very funny because Zotac is the cheaper brand.
Yeah.
I didn't even use it, though, because I had my PNY that I had a motherboard side bracket to hold it up, which I already had installed. Like, you installed it to the motherboard, and it was like, that's probably better for support long term. And I just adjusted it for the Zotac, and it's like, this works. This is going to be better than something you clip onto the bottom of your case. So I'm just going to stick with this. The one reason I'm actually pretty confident I can recommend Zotac this time is that, you know how like there was that hubbub about the melting power connectors for the 4090 and whatnot, right?
Yeah, I remember that.
Zotac has a thing where it has a sensor built in on the card itself and a light to let you know if it's properly inserted and if there's any issues with the connection. If it's properly inserted, there's a green LED and it'll work just fine. If it's not properly inserted or there's a problem, it'll turn to a red LED and then just immediately shut off the computer.
Wow. Okay, wow.
So it's like, they're the only ones that have that. Like, MSI's, like, adapter for the power connector has, like, yellow plastic so you can see if it's not properly inserted, but Zotac's leaving no shit to chance. They're just like, we can determine this based off the sense pins. If we detect an issue with the sense pins, done.
Hey, James, what wattage PSU do you have?
1,000 watts.
Do you think 1,000 watts is enough? Basically, I'm like, do I need to upgrade to 1,200? I've heard about the power supply, or I've heard about the wattage needs. Okay,
1,000 watts is fine because it's decently rated power supply, like cold rated or above, can like deliver more than more than its rated power for the spikes. So I've had no issues with my Asus TUF 1,000 watt gold, and gold is the actual like power supply, like 80+ gold is the power supply rating. I even overclocked the Zotac, so it's using 600 watts of power.
Jesus.
And
holy electricity bill.
I've had no issues whatsoever. I've only had it for like a couple of days, but I've been running like Indiana Jones fully maxed out and no issues.
Upscaling? No upscaling, just native?
So here's the thing. I I tested it, and with DLAA so native, with path tracing and frame gen, I get anywhere between 110 and 120 FPS. Obviously, frame gen is basically almost doubling the frames. And I was like, damn, I had to have it at like DLSS balance on my 4090 to get this far. Granted, I didn't overclock my 4090, and I have overclocked the 59, but still, it's like, damn. I'm sticking to DLSS quality, though, because it's a little bit better performance, and also because of the way frame gen works, having that just little bit extra performance baseline helps with the input lag. Yeah. And I could notice the input lag a little bit with DLAA because of the lower base frame rate. But with DLSS quality, it's like, that seems like the best of both worlds.
DLSS 4 is out now, right?
Yes.
Okay.
It's out now. It's not available in Indiana Jones yet, which is a little bit disappointing. But it's still like, old DLSS at quality at 4K is going to look great no matter what. So.
Yeah. And how physically big is this Zotac? Because I think, one of the things that was like weird to me with the 59 is like the Founders editions are actually like kind of nice this time around because there's two slot, they're reasonably sized, and their new cooling solution seems slick enough from the testing that other outlets have been looking at with the Founders editions. I was wondering like how physically big is the Zotac compared to the Founders edition?
So the Zotac's specifications are the length is 330 millimeters. And it's a 3.5 slot card.
Okay.
The Founders Edition is 304 millimeters, and it's a dual slot card.
Yeah.
But people have been complaining about the fan noise with the Founders Edition.
Oh, okay.
People have been complaining about coil whine. One problem with the Founders Edition is that it doesn't have exhaust out of the case. So pretty much all 575 or 600 watts of dissipated heat is going directly at the CPU core.
Oh shit, that's not good.
So people have been saying, oh, I really want to get the Founders Edition. And if I was earlier, funnily enough, Micro Center did have some Founders Editions available, not when I got up there, but that worked out because it's like I was avoiding the Founders Edition because of that CPU cooling issue. Mm-hmm. Like I did not want
to explain to me, like I'm five, what does it mean when it's dual slot? Does it actually have two PCI things that pop in?
No. So, you know, when you install a graphics card and you have the different brackets that you need to basically remove from the case itself.
Back of the case. Yeah.
Yes. Dual slot means that you only need to remove two of them and it doesn't take up any physical space beyond those slots.
When somebody that makes sense. Okay.
When somebody said, like for the Zotac, I said it's like 3.5 slot. It means it takes three of the brackets, but the physical dimensions of the card mean that the actual space is taking up what would be that fourth bracket, even if it's not the full bracket.
Yeah. Nothing else could take the bracket because it'd be
exactly excluded or whatever.
Okay. So yeah, because when someone said dual slot, my lizard brain was like, so it like it uses two of the PCI like plugins and like it covers like my 4090 covers one, an additional one, but yeah, it's a dual slot. So, okay. Basically, I'm thinking, like, if I were to replace it, do I need to account for that? It sounds like no. But I'll do my research.
Yeah. Any other games you've tested it out on, James?
So here's a little niche thing that I'm probably the only person that's going to say something about this. The way that NVIDIA handled their display headers on previous cards was incredibly annoying. It was actually one thing that was a downgrade when I originally swapped from that 7900 XTX to a 4090. What I mean by that is that on cards prior to the 5000 series, the way that display headers worked is that NVIDIA cards had four display headers. But if you used display stream compression for a display, that would use two display headers, which means that, for example, I have three 4K 160 hertz displays, but you need to use display stream compression to get the full bandwidth available to each of them. So on my 4090, I had to run two of them at a lower bit, like a lower color depth at 4K 120 instead of the full refresh rate, because if I use the DSC for my main monitor, I could only ever have one more of those monitors with DSC enabled or both of that, the other ones with DSC disabled. In addition to that, because of how it works with how a DLDSR, which is their like super sampling built in to the GPUs works, you can't enable that if you had DSC enabled at all. With the 5090, because they've updated to DisplayPort 2.1a, they completely overhauled how the display headers work, and I can run all three of my monitors at their full refresh rate, color depth, and resolution, no problems, and I can finally get access to DLDSR, which means that I've been like booting up some games and being like, I wonder how this looks or runs super sampled at 6K down to 4K. Like, it's still rendering at 6K, but obviously my monitor itself is only 4K. And there's a lot of games in my backlog that I haven't played yet that it's like the 4090, I could run them at 4K, but it's like, even if the 5090 isn't a massive upgrade, now I basically get free super sampling in a bunch of games. Like, I booted up, I haven't played Dragon Quest 3 HD2D yet, but I did boot up Octopath Traveler 2, and that runs at 6K 120 on a 5090, no problem whatsoever.
And so I don't have the same technical acumen, but I do know that one thing I'm limited at right now is that I have a DisplayPort, I believe, 2.0, which means that if I want full RGB 4K, I can't get 144 without overclocking the monitor, or it changes it to a lower color depth if I want to do the higher frame rate. Basically, it's a trade-off that I have to make, color depth or frame rate, because of my DisplayPort rather than HDMI 2.1 or whatever it is.
Yeah, and that's not a problem with the 5090 anymore. So if nothing else, just that upgrade alone has made me like pretty happy with the upgrade, because that's a quality of life thing that for a bunch of games I can take advantage of that I wasn't able to before. Like, for example, like I know that it's not the best example because the game has super sampling built in, so I could just do it like internally, but I booted up Trails for Daybreak, disabled anti-aliasing entirely, and just did the 6K internal resolution. It's like, man, has no jagged lines whatsoever. I don't need anything.
That's impressive.
Like downsampling from 6K, and it's like, for games that do have the super sampling built in, that, I mean, that's not really something I need to use, but not every game does that, even though they should. Like, I booted up Sonic Shower Generations, and it has a rendering resolution scale, but it doesn't let you go above 100% internally. So I set it to 6K, and it's like, this is running at 6K 120, it looks perfect, it's like, just really solid stuff.
Oh no, I you can't even convince me to get the 4K. Now if you're talking about 6K, oh fuck. That's it looks like 5090 is a crazy, crazy workhorse powerhouse.
Yeah,
you know what this reminds me of?
I'm excited to try VR. Like, spoiler alert, I'm not actually on my desktop right now because I'm assuming meth heads cut the fiber optic cables thinking they were going to get a payday in copper. So Frontier is repairing it. So I'm actually at my parents' place on my laptop. But once that gets sorted out, hopefully later today, I'm going to boot up some VR, see how the encoder performance improvements helps things. And also, just like performance in general, because one thing that people seem to have noticed is that the performance improvement scales with resolution, and VR is like higher than 4K resolution most of the time. So I'm pretty excited for the improvements there.
What were you saying earlier, Brian?
The James talking about like his downsampling experimenting reminds me of it feels like a bygone era, but it's related. Durante, one of his first like tools was Jito Sato. Do you remember that? It was before like DSR and other things were as common. Like, in order to actually downsample, you kind of had to, I hope I get the memory of this right, you had to like almost trick your GPU control panel to render in a resolution higher than your monitor thought it supported. And basically Jito Sato was just like an applet that made that a little bit more convenient. And that was before it was all baked in, and you know, you could just select 200% internal rendering resolution, or go into your GPU control panel and do it at least easily. It was very much a consumer, like a specialist thing. And I remember messing with that on my 1080p monitor, like around the time of like the 980 or the 1080, like at that time frame. I'm like, I remember that. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, now I have to do like frame gen and DLSS to, you know, add just that native resolution. But cool to see that we're back in the realm where at least games like Octopath Traveler, like you said, or Trails games, you could go back in kind of that playground and super sample the hell out of it to completely eliminate the need for anti-aliasing.
To just murder image quality issues with my bare hands.
Now James has the fun task of anytime he reviews a game on PC, he has to put a disclaimer at the very top saying, this is on hardware you're not able to get in the next 2 years.
3 months, yeah.
I want him to put in his review like a 50 megabyte picture downsampled from like 30K with NVIDIA Ansel and whatever. Yeah, I want you to zoom into like 3,000% and there's still no jaggies.
gets that fun task that sometimes me, Adam, and Mikhail deal with, where we get press assets that are like, I'm like, here's 12,000 by 12,000 PNG. We have it here. And then he has to downsample that into a real resolution that people actually want to render.
Did this banner art need to be 20,000 pixels tall? Yes.
Before we get into news, I just want to say that as a one third game news, I don't know if anyone else in here got chosen, but I got chosen for that Elden Ring Night Rain network test thing. So I guess at least one of us here can speak to whatever the hell that thing is.
When does that start again?
I don't know. I'd have to look at it, but I just want to say you've been chosen.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, sorry for interrupting you. Go on.
No, I was just going to say, you know, thanks, James, for taking the slot to talk about, you know, hardware and, you know, GPU software and all that stuff. Just we had a good opportunity to fit it in here, and it was timely and, you know, relevant. So there we go.
Okay, this network test is on February 14th to 16th. So my Valentine's Day is with fellow Elden Ringers, I guess.
There you go. You'll have to pick two significant others.
Two random significant others.
Where are we dropping?
I hope they have free chat and just enter Happy Valentine's Day, bro.
Okay. I don't think they had any new articles or reviews up on the site, though. Kite has kind of sneakily put in a few guides for Pokemon Trading Card Game and Gundam Breaker 4, like DLCs. So if you're playing those games, Kite's been kind of sneakily putting those features up, but no new reviews. Obviously, those are all going to come in the next couple of weeks. Going into news, not a lot of things, but a few interesting things to talk about here. The kind of the biggest and kind of the most headlining news we have here, and it's not really a trailer, more of a demonstration or something like that, but we got a new visual look at the upcoming Trails in the Sky First Chapter remaster. And what this basically is a picture-in-picture comparison of the original game on the PSP, and obviously available on, you know, PC and all that, and the new remaster. And it starts off with, you know, showing a combat, you know, sprite animation from the original game, and then showing, you know, the fully 3D animated from the new game. And then the back half of the trailer is pretty much just traversing an area of the map with the picture-in-picture, you know, original Trails in the Sky on the, you know, on the upper left, and then the remake following it in the main picture, just with backing music. It's the re-rendition of the combat theme. Not any dialogue, not any voiceover, just kind of showing. It's basically a demonstration of this is a faithful, not one-to-one, but a faithful as hell remaster. And it ends with like showing that the buildings and the trees and the park benches are in the same location. It's really just kind of a fun little, very show-offy kind of visual.
You know who's a fake fan when they watch this trailer and they're like, oh, is this the new battle theme for the song, this new remix that I'd never heard before?
So nobody remembers the Zanmai.
Yeah, so the backing track, a lot of people think it's like a new theme, but this theme was Falcom releases this album, is called Zanmai, and they're basically like very big bombastic arrangements of themes in their games. So there's like the kind of big bombastic like Zanmai range of sophisticated.
Is this basically the equivalent of like Atlas's Super Arrange or whatever?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Super Range It was also a thing for Falcom OSTs in the past.
I'm thinking Etrian Odyssey. Okay.
Yeah, well, the Etrian Odyssey Super Range, that's Yuzo Koshiro, and he started it at Falcom, so it's the same fit.
Yeah.
In fact, I remember that the Etrian Odyssey 4 Super Range, a lot of the guest composers for the arrangements were actually ex-Falcom folks, so it's
There's a lot of you can tell there's a lot of care and love especially the picture-in-picture comparisons of traversing the environment and trying to get that same structure of the environment, but obviously trying to reimagining what traversing the liberal looks like in full 3D, what do these actual structures look like in full 3D compared to the more isometric view back then. And I really like the little attention to detail, when Estelle is going from back from her battle stance into her running stance, she throws her bow staff behind her back to get back in that running stance. It's really, really cool to see that attention to detail, because that's definitely it's like a lot of what I said about when they revealed this remake. It's a lot of the charm and kind of what this hinges upon, this remake, is Estelle's body language. Estelle is very much a very energetic, very Genki type of character, and just seeing some of those animations reflect that her personality is very, it's really cool to see. It's always what I wanted to see.
I don't know how seamless it is, but in that same area when they go into that, it's been too long since I played a game to know exactly what that little civilized area is. But there's a loading screen on the original game, and in the remake, it's seamless. But she puts her, her staff away and twirls it over her head and puts it on her back, you've gone from the field to the town. Only there's no loading screen. It's seamless, at least in that particular instance, which is just real cool to see. Mm-hmm.
That's
there's no UI pop up either. It's not like there's a big splash in the center of the screen that says now you are in blah blah blah. It's just no, now you're in an area. It's just you're going to put your weapon away. You don't need to say any more than that.
I really hope they do this where where you're at if you look at the physical sign entering that village. Mm-hmm. There'll be a sign that's hey, you're in the village now. And you mm-hmm. just it because you see the sign there.
Yeah, you don't need something to shout at you to be like, here's where your waypoint is, or whatever. Here's where the city limit is, or here's where the enemies start showing up.
Noria Village.
It's been too long.
Mm-hmm.
But just a real cool little demonstration from Falcom. And we have a few other trailers that I didn't know if they were really worth discussing. There's the Kingdom Come 2 Deliverance 2. They have their big CGI week away from launch trailer, but it's just kind of we've already seen how the game looks. We've already seen extended gameplay, things like that. Obviously, Adam's already talked about it. People have already had previews of it. So the CGI trailer is just really celebrating the impending launch, but it's pretty cool. We have a couple updates that are separate from trailers here that I detailed. This one's kind of small, but just kind of interesting. Slated to release in April, we learned this last November, Mandragora is kind of like a 2.5D Metroidvania that is releasing on April 17th. So they've already announced the release date, but this week they just announced that they're adding a subtitle. So now it is Mandragora Whispers of the Witch Tree. And it's like, sure, that's fine. It just feels interesting that it's so late in the game that they've already decided on when this thing is launching and now they're changing the title. So maybe not that consequential, just kind of like, oh, that's not the order of operations I would have expected. And then talking about the title, like why they changed it or why they updated it, a lot of it is kind of like hard to nail down speech. They're like, the community has made it clear that this game is more than another action RPG. It encompasses everything players are looking for in a dark fantasy adventure, hence the new title. And we're like, okay.
It's basically like a way to kind of keep the door open. Like if they want to release like a follow-up title in the same world, they can have a different sort of Mandragora, Electric Boogaloo. Cool, great. I was skipping the Gamatsu write-up, and I kind of chuckled at the last name of the Knights Peak Vice President of Publishing.
Hey, he's Italian, Vitaly.
He's a Vitaly, just like, are you guys
related? And also, I didn't realize this, but narrative design by Brian Mitsoda. Brian, that's an original Vampire the Masquerade, and I don't know what else he's done. All I know is that he did Vampire the Masquerade. Then I think he was dormant for several years. Then he was brought back for Bloodlines 2, and then he was removed from that project, which sucked. I don't know what else he's done, but it's cool to see him popping back up here. Like, oh, I wasn't expecting to read that.
I also wonder if they just added the subtitle to the game just to, like, make it more Googleable. Because if you just type in Mandragora right now, you're just going to get a genus of flowers and plants.
That's so true, too. Yeah, I didn't think about the SEO side.
Everything is SEO. Alex would be proud.
Speaking of Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines 2.
Yeah, so whenever there's an update for Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines 2, I shouldn't say this. I should be like optimistic and as charitable as possible. And, you know, but it's hard for me just because of the history of that game's development. The most recent update is another dev diary, and they've been doing these frequently, I don't know about frequently, but regularly for the last years. And this is I think dev diary 25 or 24, all about combat. And the combat it's pretty interesting on its face. They talk about how a lot of like attention to detail, like things like your basic attack animations will slightly change depending on which vampire clan you are. And on the website, they show like little gifs of what these things different look like. Like the Tremors, who are kind of like posh, like use like almost like, I don't know if karate is the right word, but a very formal fighting style, where the Bruja use like, you know, they take lumbering swings, and another clan, I'm not sure which, like swipes like a feral cat for the basic attack. And it's one of those things where, like, I don't know how impactful it is, but it's a nice attention to detail, like from a first person perspective, actually making you feel like your clan choice mattered. And they talk about like telekinesis, pulling enemies to you. They have a cool little animation here where they pull a rifle away from a mesmerized enemy. While you have it floating in front of you, you fire it at another enemy, and then they chuck it at a third enemy. So it's like the sales pitch. I'm getting what they're going for here. It's just that, you know, Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines, like, I don't think you can ask anyone why they liked it. You got, I was belaboring the point, but you got there. Like, why anyone liked that original game? Why is it a cult classic? It's not because it had good combat. And I'm not saying that means ignore it, but it just means that it's not what people who played the original game are looking for or think.
But everyone loved the sewer section.
Yeah.
I mean, sewer sections in general, but that one is a prime example of a bad one.
Yeah, and this is a little bit of a tangent, but I didn't get to bring it up last week. Between playing Kingdom Come Deliverance 1 and the game I'm covering in the next couple weeks, I did go back to Starfield, and I have a point to this. Starfield and Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines have like the opposite mythos when it comes to like quest rewards and, you know, RPG progression. In Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines, you get no EXP. I believe it's no EXP from combat. It's all quest. You know, you solve the problem, you undertook a quest, you helped the person, or you didn't help a person, you were selfish, whatever. You get EXP for that. Whatever you kill or don't kill does not give you EXP. Where Starfield is like, you can do a quest, you know, that is multiple steps in multiple places and get 100 EXP, or you can kill two spacers and get 60 EXP a pop. And it's like, it feels unbalanced in that way. And I re-recognize that I greatly prefer the former to the latter. So I guess what I'm getting at is that I hope that the sequel, despite all of its, you know, change in developer and, you know, struggle development, feels at least in that way a little bit. Like, I hope so. I have no idea how confident I should be that it hits the same vibes or that hits the same notes. But yeah, a cool little demonstration of some combat. And the website, well, we have it linked in our news post, does show like their little animated GIFs of what the things look like. So it seems promising. Like, it seems fine. But it's currently still slated to release this year, but I think they've said it for a few years in a row that they plan to release this year. So we'll see how that pans out. And then as I was looking at, you know, other websites' coverage of RPGs, this is one that I caught from Gamatsu through a source. I might get this wrong. Ryokucha. They basically upload, you know, direct witness of the Famitsu Weekly
Ryokucha is basically there. They kind of get like an advanced copy of Famitsu, so they usually leak out, you know, like what's going to be in like the next issue of Famitsu, like hours before the issue comes out digitally. Mm-hmm. So you kind of get it first. That's like how Sal and Gamatsu like upload like the review scores from Famitsu before the issue comes out, because Ryokucha usually leaks them, mm-hmm. and then kind of like a Spark Notes, Cliff Notes, like some of like the new headlines or new news issue.
Mm-hmm. And then basically the headline here, I read it and I'm like, I guess I should at least mention that in passing, is that based on a director at NIS, or not NIS, is it NIS?
No, it's not Idea Factory.
Idea Factory, that's it, sorry. Yeah, but this year might be the year that we see a new numbered Hyperdimension Neptunia entry, because they've been working on a new story for the past 3-4 years. And they're working hard to announce the latest numbered title as the big milestone of the series' 15th anniversary. So we'll maybe finally have a new...
Okay, I want you to guess, when was the last time they released a numbered Neptunia game?
Let's see. I know they've remastered... Okay.
Whenever Mega Dimension released.
That 2015. That's the last time 15. They... Yeah. Jesus. So that was Mega Neptunia, Neptunia V2, and then everything else since then has either been a re-release on like a port of an earlier game to another platform, or a spin-off game, and that's it. So, I mean, yeah, like Mega Dimension Neptunia was actually like a pretty decent game. Like, it's definitely one of the mainline games that's like, hey, there's actually a pretty fun, good time, you know, a decent RPG. A lot of the other ones, you know. Maybe less than stellar, but that game, pretty okay. So I don't know what a new numbered Neptunia game would look like, because the whole series kind of pokes fun. It's a big parody of the game industry. Like, their whole world is called game industry, and obviously the setup is that, you know, the consoles, handhelds are kind of represented by like these anime girls in it. So obviously Neptune is a representation of a Sega console that never came out, like the theoretical quote-unquote Neptune console that would have come out after Dreamcast, for example, or how Vert is Xbox, Noir and Blanc are Sony, but that used to be like PlayStation 3 and PlayStation Portable. I guess Blanc was like also Vita, and Blanc was PS4 at some point too, and then it wasn't Blanc. It was who was it? I forgot.
Dare you confuse your Neptunia?
I know it's Noir and Noir.
There's Zim and Zom, or whatever the two twins are. Were they?
Yeah. Oh my god!
Rim and Ram. Ram and Rem.
Ram and Ram is under Blanc. Yeah.
It's 3-0 now.
What? No. That's, they've always had that. Ram and Rom were before that, dude. What?
Well, I think in the newest game, Vert's gonna die.
Oh no, my poor Xbox.
Vert's gonna go back to their home planet.
So either way, like this is the way. So these characters are representations of like different consoles or in the console space.
Josh, I have bad news.
What?
I don't know why I know this, because I found it amusing, but I know Mega Dimension Neptunia V2 used to have an overwhelmingly positive review rating on Steam. It's now only 94% positive, which is only good enough for very positive.
It's over.
No longer it's overwhelming.
It's over.
It was Noir and Uni. Noir and Uni are the Sony. They used to represent PS3 and PSP, and then PS4 and Vita, and then Blanc, along with Ram and Rom, was the Nintendo side, and Blanc used to be like Wii or Wii U, and Ram and Rom were like the 3DS, because they're like, you know, there's two screens on those systems, and DS and 3DS, so that's why they're twins.
I know they kind of ran out of characters, and so they start using like companies. There's like a Nisa-chan or Falcom or something.
Well, Nisa and If were always there from the very, very beginning, but they started expanding. Like, so there'll be some spin-offs that have like game companies in it, like the Noir's SRPG developed by Sting. Like, they had characters from other companies like Broccoli, I think, and Tekken. Like it's kind of weird, because they have like they sometimes have like characters that represent series rather than companies. Like Tekken obviously represents Tekken, but then there might be another Tails a character or character inspired by Tails, for example. And then Cave, but then there's a character named Cave who represents, you know, the shmup developer Cave, and Mages, you know, represents developer Mages. you know. But then they'll have Nitro Plus, Nisa, they're just called that.
Look, the only game that I spent $2,000 on is a cave game, so I'll tell you that.
Wait, what?
Yes, I bought the actual arcade board, okay?
Oh, okay.
What cave game?
I bought Mushihime-sama Black Mushihime-sama Futari Black Label. There's only 300 copies made, so the PC board was like $2,000.
I think it would have like a Falcom character named Falcom.
I mean, so you could have gotten a GPU for that price, but just get the arcade cabinet or whatever.
It might be a better investment.
Are you sure you've not spent that much on Genshin Impact?
Well, but we're talking about game that you can own.
These are hard questions for Chao. He can't reveal this publicly, okay?
Well, I think Chao probably purposely doesn't want to think about how much money he spent on Gacha.
Look, I have one credit this game, so...
Either way, I don't know what that new numbered Neptunia game will look like, since it's been so long since the last one, and the game industry has obviously changed a lot. So they're still trying to parody like a reflection of the modern state of the game industry, I don't know what the fuck that game looks like, because the game industry from up until now, from 2015, like, has changed even severely. Like, think about this, like, within like that past decade, since there's no Neptunia, you know, that was like when Fate Go barely started coming out. You know, that was still Fate Go was still a new thing, and now it's like, you know, Fortnite is now a thing. Free to play games are more popular than ever. Like, you know, not just on mobile, but also it's also seeped into a lot of the consoles.
They're gonna introduce a new character named Gacha Chan.
You know, they probably did some spinoff. And then they probably, you know, will they have like some sort of like Steam representation in that as well, since Steam has gotten become more popular in Japan since the last numbered release. You know, who knows? But I mean, I just want a good game out of it, and hopefully it's funny too. But I don't know how it's like the anime equivalent of like, how do you release a new Grand Theft Auto that parodies, you know, America, with the modern state of America. You know, how do you make a parody out of that? But it's like, it's a clown show in itself, you know? It's like, you know, the Onion, like, how does the Onion operate and make fun of reality when reality is like, a lot of aspects of reality are just, you know, a complete shit show.
Yeah.
These days. So it's kind of weird. It's kind of weird. So who knows? But you know, the news of a new numbered Neptunia was already kind of hinted at the previous showcase of like when Compile Heart was showcasing their upcoming projects. The big thing in this week's Famitsu that they wanted to showcase was the upcoming projects of Compile Heart, starting with like a new third person shooter that's not an RPG called Scarlet Salvation. And that one is actually really funny because it's basically Returnal. Like, they made Returnal, but you have an anime girl as your main protagonist. It's basically the same narrative setup, because there's an amnesia protagonist that progresses the game through death loops. Like, there's like a whole narrative element of looping through death, like Returnal. And just like Returnal, it has like three like over the shoulder, like almost shmup like enemies with color coded bullets, and then you have a dash that can shift through, you know, obstacles and bullets and so forth.
I need to actually watch a video of this, because I really like Returnal.
Yeah, but I will keep your expectations in check. You know,
I understand it is an Idea Factory game. I understand.
But there's
keep in mind, the last Idea Factory game that I actually tried to get any sort of hype for was Arca Alchemist, and we both know how that went.
They also announced a new game called Magical Librarian Ariana, The Book of Seven Heroes, and that's a side-scrolling RPG, but it's like, they only showed off like a key art and like one screenshot. They're saying there's gonna be more info on it on like spring, and that's coming summer in Japan for PS5, PS4, and Switch. So that's an RPG that'll probably be relevant to us. There's another RPG that they've previously revealed called Todokero Tatakae Calamity Angels for PS5, PS4, Switch. I think that's summer as well. It got delayed to summer last year. And then they announced the new shmup that's being co-developed by M2 called Zeleste. So they had like a whole, you know, showcase of like upcoming Compile Heart. You know, which is hopefully all of them, if not most of them, are cool and fun. But once again, I have to keep expectations in check. It's not because I dislike Compile Heart and Idea Factory's developers. It's like, it's, they kind of need to up their game, man. I just, they're so close to being good games, and most of them are kind of fall flat for me a lot of the time.
I think they just come to bad design choices most of the time. That's kind of like me with them, so you should try to avoid them.
I mean, I don't blame anyone who... There was also a Xenoblade X Definitive Edition section in this week's Famitsu as well, that it doesn't have anything, any new info. It does have an art render of Luxar in Definitive Edition in it, though, which is kind of like our first look at Luxar in Definitive Edition. They have the new elf-like character. I forgot her name. Was it Neil Nile or whatever? Render for that as well. And then they basically confirmed that she's a... how do you pronounce it? The Q-L-U-R-I-A-N. Clurian? Clurian? I don't know. But, yeah. But other than that... Well, you know, that's kind of the bulk of like the Sniptoon.
Well, it'll be a while since we've actually, like, I mean, I know Nathan will probably be very interested, so hopefully we'll get him right on that whenever it's announced and is nearing release. We're already going to go into sales. This is work for a game that we were able to discuss a little bit in the last couple of episodes of the podcast. Enter Magnolia, of course, released just a few weeks ago. And then the publisher announced, this is Binary Haze, that Ender Lilies and Ender Magnolia together have sold more than 2 million units. Now, the last update we had was back in middle of last year that Ender Lilies had sold 1.5 million units. So basically, in that time frame, Ender Lilies plus the new release of Ender Magnolia, you know, early access onto full release, have, you know, totaled 2 million, so 500,000 roughly, you know, napkin math for Ender Magnolia. So seems like a pretty good success, and word of mouth, like we talked about when we discussed these games, for both games have been really, really strong. So hopefully they'll continue to have very long legs and be good catalog titles for the publisher. We've only got a few new dates here. We're already kind of wrapping up the news. There wasn't a ton of headlines that I was able to find to talk about this week. Momodora Moonlit Farewell, this launched last year, early in the year, for PC in January. It will be getting its console release. Yeah, it'll get its console release, that's Switch, Xbox Series, and PlayStation, on February 6th. So within, you know, less than a week of us recording this, probably within a few days of anyone listening to this, or already happened. So cool that it's getting its console release. And we did get a release trailer for that, just a minute of, you know, gameplay montage for the console announcement. We have Rise of the Ronin. This is one, I think, I forget if we brought it up in a recording session or if we were just in a Discord room. That's got to be slated for PC at some point, right? Because for Team Ninja, that's kind of the cadence some of their previous console exclusive releases have had. Like Neo 2 eventually made its way to PC, you know, 10 months or so after release. Rise of the Ronin, released last year in March. It'll be releasing on PC this year in March. It'll be about a year, releasing on Steam on March 10th. And they kind of talked, there was a trailer talking about it, you know, DirectX 12, 8K resolution, 120 FPS, all the usual things. Now, their last PC port, I believe, was, it was a different team within Team Ninja, though. I was thinking Wolong didn't have the greatest launch, but I guess it was a different team. So I don't know if there's a lot to draw from that as precedent for Rise
of the Ronin. I guess it's like the closest would be like is like Neo 2. How was Neo 2 on launch, you know?
Not great.
Yeah, that's the thing.
So yeah, Neo 2 was not great. Wolong, which was a different team, was also not great, slightly worse.
Dynasty Warriors is Koei Tecmo, but not Team Ninja.
There's also Stranger of Paradise. Well,
remember when they shaved everyone's hair in Stranger of Paradise? Oh, yeah, that's right. 10 FPS?
Oh, God, that was a crazy PC port. Holy shit. Thank you for the reminder.
I guess that means we'll have to update this. Obviously, on our sidebar on our website, we try to give as much credit to the devs and the publishers. And for here, I didn't realize Rise of the Ronin was published by Sony on PlayStation 5, and then it's going to be published by Koei Tecmo.
Yeah, it's kind of weird how that works. Yeah, like the Neo games
It's sort of like co-published by Sony and Koei Tecmo on like the PlayStation version, and then it's just Koei Tecmo for the PC version.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because like the Neo games were exclusive to Sony platforms for also time amount.
Like for example, when I asked for review codes for like Neo 2 on PlayStation, it was for through Sony, not Koei Tecmo.
And we've seen that with like Nintendo on some of their previously exclusive, Switch releases and things.
Yeah, like and that. Just to be clear though, like Final Fantasy Remake and Rebirth, those are all Square Enix, obviously in agreement with Sony, but like they weren't like published by Sony on PlayStation in the same way.
Well, I mean, here we go, Rise of the Ronin.
I'll play it maybe at that time.
Well, get a 5090 and run it at 8K and report back.
Okay, all the way.
And then say it works on your machine.
I think the crazy thing about that is that I'm pretty sure DLSS performance for 8K is just running it at 4K.
Nice. So sick 8K resolution support. I think it's really funny that they're also gonna support not only ultrawide but super ultrawide. So ultrawide is 21:9, right? I forgot what super ultrawide.
I think it's 32:9.
It's 32:9, which is literally you just put two regular monitors side by side and fucking glue them together.
Yeah. I don't know who was to the 10 people out there who's like, yes, Rise of the Ronin's my 32:9 monitor.
Look! I know people use ultra wide monitors for Final Fantasy 14. Apparently, it gives you a huge advantage.
I'm
gonna be real here. I would not use an ultra wide for most things, but I've thought about getting an ultra wide specifically because it gives you a much, much better field of view in Final Fantasy 14. It is. I can understand why people use those UAV mods when just getting an ultra wide monitor gives you that benefit anyway. So it's like just fucking zooming out like you. Like if you had an ultra wide,
ultra wide adoptability has been rising. So I mean, I definitely have a good amount of friends like who really love their ultra wide monitors.
Man,
do they make
21:9 4K monitors? Because I feel like that would actually be like a perfect pairing for this new GPU.
Do your research and report back.
Let's see, and yeah, I mean. Rise of the Ronin, I mean, this is a pretty solid game. I really enjoyed my time with it. It's one of those things, like, I don't know how more people will feel about it, because it's not mythical or supernatural in the same way that, like, Neo is. Very down-to-earth, but very, very samurai-focused. Very, kind of a hard-boiled story, in a sense. With not great open world, very dated open world mechanics. And activities, but it's still, it was still a pretty awesome.
And the last thing that I have here is a shutdown announcement. This is the global version of Atelier Resleriana. This is Forgotten Alchemy and the Polar Knight Liberator. This is the one that released last year globally in January. The global version will be shutting down at the end of March, March 28th. The Japanese version will continue. And then this, of course, is not the same as the Atelier Resleriana other game that is releasing this year for consoles, and I forget the subtitle of that one.
This is the Red Alchemist and the White Guardian.
So yeah,
this is the global version of Atelier Resleriana that released last year is shutting down on March 28th. Go ahead, Joe.
So I was gonna say my friend that spent over like $100,000 in Genshin, he's also a big Atelier fan, and he said this game was not generous. The animation takes forever to get through things. Even he didn't even play it after a couple months. So this game must be God forbid.
I don't think it's like a bad game in terms of like it doesn't have like it definitely has problems, but I don't think it was like a really bad game. Like I played it for a few months and I actually really like the battle system in this game. That's one of the big hopes that I have for the console game set in its world is I really hope they like have an evolution of that battle system. It's like basically a timeline based, turn based battle system where you can there's a lot of if then effects of like pushing your character's actions and delaying actions of other enemies and grouping them up in the timeline, like there's a lot of like if then statements in its battle system that I was like, oh, I really like this, you know. But but it definitely has that.
When you say if then, I just think gambit system.
But you know, if he finds it unfriendly when it comes to the gacha system for someone, well, who obviously sucks
that's the inherent fucking weakness of like any of these games, you know, like, you know, Some of you heard this before, you know, this is a cool game, but the gacha aspect of it sucks. You know, guess what? That's like most of them. So that's the thing, right?
But I don't know, maybe we'll look forward to the console game. It's just,
I wasn't a big fan of, like, I like the bones of this game gameplay wise. I also don't, I think the gacha aspect fucking sucks.
It has good ideas that you hope are leveraged.
Yeah.
You know, going forward.
That's a really cool thing that Tales of, what was that? Was it? It was Cristoria that did, not Luminaria. Cristoria, you know, it was a quote unquote old mobile game, more recent, but like it shut down, you know, years ago. But it did this thing where it had previous characters from the Tales series exist in that world as like actual characters that already existed in that world. So like, you know, like your characters were like, was trained by like, you know, the Tales of Phantasia protagonist, I already forgot his name.
What?
Or so forth. Yeah. And like there were other characters. Class. Yes.
All Destiny, was it the original Destiny translation? There will be like this quiz puzzle for you with these two characters, Arch and Kles, but that's the English translation. They're like, oh, it's like our names had two R's in it. Can you guess what our name is? So I think his name became Kress from it instead.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh.
And like Pharah from like Eternia was like a childhood friend of like one of the party members, I think, something like that. But they were already like, it's cool. I like when they integrate them into the world. So Resident Rihanna had like a weird spin on this where like the protagonists of like previous Atalia games got like isekai'd into their world, but they're integrating themselves as characters in that world. You know, they're searching for a way back to their like their world games, but in the meantime they're finding their own like, you know, place in that world that they were transported. So they kind of exist in that world, integrated in. So, and I was like, that's cool. You know, that's neat. Or why not? That's like, it's like kind of like a fun, just like, you know, just have them interacting with one another. So, this shutting down, the global version shutting down for Atali and Resident Rihanna is, it's kind of like a no-brainer because the Atali series is, outside of Japan, a pretty niche series. You know, you kind of need a strong, dedicated fan base that kind of shows up for it, you know, day after day to keep this running and also to regularly spend money on it. And when you already have like a smaller install base from the get-go compared to other RPGs, it wasn't gonna last. And there was also that the ownership transferred a few months back of Atalia Resolirana, both on the Japanese and global side, where Koei Tecmo took full ownership of it and like basically cut Akatsuki out of it several months ago as well. And I imagine that probably factored into it as a consequence too. Where Koei Tecmo was like, the global version of this game is not hitting, you know, internal targets, and we're not going to spend the resources to try to salvage it.
I mean, just overestimate the numbers after seeing Rise of Sales. That's what I'm guessing. But
even when they announced it, it was kind of strange because they were like upfront. They're upfront with what it was. Like, it wasn't a lie or a fib, but they were like, this is the mainline game, but it is a gacha game, but it is both. Like, trust us, believe us. It was just a little, the messaging was a little strange.
And now you have like a lot of like your Atelier fan base, understandably, like, you know, a little frustrated because like there's a mainline game, but now we have no more access. There's no way to actually complete this game in English now. There's, you won't see the end of the story in English, even though it's a quote unquote mainline game.
Mm-hmm.
That feels shitty, you know.
Kevin gotcha.
It does feel shitty, but also as someone that does play Atelier games, I never believed them for a fucking second there was actually a mainline game, and seeing them shut it down like this is like, yeah, it wasn't developed by Gust. So it's like, how is it a mainline game?
I don't know. I never followed the story enough, and the story is still ongoing in Japan as well. That's still getting story updates, and they have no plans of shutting that down. So I cannot tell you one way or the other, like how
at least we are getting the actual like proper console version of this, which I assume is actually going to be localized because they don't have to keep.
Yeah, so here's the thing. Yeah, I mean, it was already announced for both like all overseas release when it was revealed. So we already got like an English trailer of that and everything, and English press release. But it's not the same story. It's a different story with a different main cast set in the same
world. Oh, so it's not like Seal and the Surge offline. It's literally just a completely different story then.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Do you think we might get an Atelier? Not even gonna fucking pronounce that. Res Lerion offline in the future, because like we have we literally have like historical precedent that Gust does this, but this isn't developed by Gust. So
that would solely be a question of whenever the Japanese release shuts down and what they decide to do from there, because it's very unlikely. Like no one wants to follow the Mega Man X dive model. Pretty much, no one wants to commit to that, and no one wants to release that, because one, if they announce that, there's no reason to ever play the live mobile game right now. And two, if they it's kind of walking this tightrope, like if they standardize that as a practice in the industry, then
they should.
I wish they should, but two, it would incentivize player behavior to shift to like, okay, let's not, why even play this game when we can just wait for the offline version if they standardize that, you know? So if that becomes
more, I can see that,
why even play it in the first place? So it's a really shitty situation because of the inherent gacha game model, you know, of not even gacha game, of the inherent games as a service model. So it's just like, well, I don't know. I wish there was a better environment and better situation. I don't know. Hopefully, here's my hope. In the 0.001% chance that Nintendo during its Switch 2 Nintendo Direct will announce a Dragalia Lost offline console game version for Switch 2. There you go.
I mean, it has a completed story. It has everything there, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just make a console version.
As someone who doesn't dip their toes in this water very much, for whatever reason, my fringe outside perspective is that when Dragalia Lost was live and active, it didn't seem like it got that much buzz. But since it shut down, it seems like people remember it very fondly. Like
it has probably the best video game soundtrack in a while. And then the thing that carries it is the soundtrack, the Dalco music. Like,
yeah, it's one of those things like a hindsight is 2020. You really don't appreciate what you don't really appreciate something until
the game has flaws. And yeah, you can see why it closed down. I could talk all day about why it closed down. But there is definitely some good moments with it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. So yeah, I mean, I'm very interested. I really, really hope that Res Lerion console game has that same battle system as the mobile game. I really like it. I just wish.
And even though it is not a console version of the same story, make that explicitly clear. It'll be interesting to see like what maybe themes, either like story themes or literal gameplay mechanics that they borrow, to see like how much of that does it carry over from this version.
Well, we see like the two protagonists from the mobile game show up in that console game, but we see the other past Atelier games integrated in that role show up in that game. I mean, there's a lot of questions that we'll get answers to eventually once Yumiya comes out, and then they can focus marketing on that.
It's kind of weird in all that talk. Yeah, Yumiya is a month and a half away, and then that one will be further down. So
at least it's not like that one year where they had like three or four Atelier console releases in a year. I forgot which year that was, but they had
It was like the Marie remake. It was a Ryza game, and then Remaster.
The Star Celebration one that had like all the protagonists in one game, and then like it was like Sophie 2 also.
That's what it was. It was Sophie 2.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, man, that was a weird year. A really weird year.
Yeah, Gus can really turn them out when they need to.
They were like, all right, Square Enix, let us handle this. We'll release everything in the same time frame too. It's like, oh no, don't do it.
And that covers us for all the news here. So a little bit more of a quieter week. But next week, of course, the big topic, releasing just a few days from the time of this recording, is Kingdom Come Deliverance 2. That'll be like the first of a series of releases throughout all of February and into March. So Adam will be covering that. Obviously, I just replayed the first game, so it'll be nice to have a kind of a back and forth. And I know Josh has touched the first game as well. Back and forth about comparing, you know, the sequel to the original and the different, like, development, I don't know, environment between the two games. And obviously going into all the other, like, I guess not next week because it'll be a little bit too early, but, you know, we'll have that Elden Ring Night Rain beta. Wait, will that be next week? When you said Valentine's Day?
Valentine's Day, yeah.
So that'll be in 2 weeks, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we'll have, you know, Trails of Daybreak 2, Avowed, Yakuza, and then the big one at the end of the month, Monster Hunter, of course. So it's going to be pretty exciting from here on out. So, of course, a lot of those articles and reviews as they are written and created will go up on our site. We'll discuss them here on the podcast. So stay tuned. If you do listen to this podcast on whatever podcast service you use, give us a like, give us a rating, give us a comment. If you so feel like it, we like to see those. Visit our site, rpgsite.net. Join our Discord, discord.gg/rpgsite. You can find us on all the social media networks. Just search for RPG Space Site. Look for our little emblem. You should be able to find us. And we'll be back next week with another episode of the TetraCast. So thank you so much for listening. Until you hear from us next time, stay safe. Take care.
Before we wrap this up, an emergency last second thing, because I just saw it. Congratulations. Big congratulations to James. I just saw and heard the news that they finally released the English translation patch for the 3DS version of Time Travelers.
Yeah, it's like I haven't really talked about it much, but yeah, that's still been a thing that people were working on for the last several years.
Yeah, they said 8 years. A big fan translation.
It's actually really funny because the whole reason I even got involved with that is I joined that Discord server when I was like, I interviewed the folks that did the fan translation for Dragon Quest Rocket Slime 3DS. And then I was like, oh, I'd be interested in helping with a project. And then, lo and behold, I ended up helping with one.
Yeah, that's awesome to see. I just saw that on my timeline right now. Pop, like, holy shit, they got it. Wow, awesome.
Any chance of doing the Vita version?
When I joined the project, I said, hey, I'd like to help with that. But the thing is that it was always focused on the 3DS version. There was even like a tool that we made to be able to like input, like, to even input our like text boxes and check for the limitations of the 3DS. Like, and we could actually see a preview of how it would look in game using like a piece of software that one of the like programmers on the team actively made. And it was really cool for helping with the workflow of it. So it would have to be completely retooled for Vita because of different text box limitations. It would probably not be too bad, but it would just...
It'll take some time if they do it.
Yeah. Yeah. If it happens.
Yeah. Okay, sorry about that. I just saw it.
Yeah. Nah, if you've listened to this far, we appreciate you that much more. Thank you so much for listening. Take care, everyone. Cool. And I didn't notice any like spots that Adam will need to edit, like any like stitching or anything I'll have to do. So hopefully this is a pretty straightforward one.
Yep, we did it. Bye.
Under an hour.
Yep.
Under an hour. What?
Yeah.
Don't ask questions. Okay, bye.
Okay.
Later.
Bye.